Welcome to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program.
And aloha, America. Welcome to the show here. It's Saturday, end of the week. We're going to be looking back at all the news from what's been going on the last 5 days. And it's just, well, you know, I wish it could be more optimistic and more positive. Starting right off, of course, if you're watching the corporate media feeds, the lead story right now is that there may be an arrest in the Chandra Levy case. And as I mentioned a week or so ago, the corporate media is so desperate to keep you looking in the wrong directions. They brought back the Tylenol case. They've been talking about JonBenet Ramsey. They're still going on about Michael Phelps and his pot bust. And, you know, they're having to report on the bad signs of the economy because if they don't, it's obvious they're trying to distract you. But there's a lot of other stuff going on that the corporate media is not telling you about, which is, of course, why you're here. And we're going to be covering a lot of that. But it is amazing just how desperate they are to grab stories that they can wave in front of you as a distraction, as a blindfold. They're literally trying to put an informational blindfold on you. And the reason that the Chandra Levy story is very, very worrisome is this story, the Gary Condit Chandra Levy issue, was the one that was being used to draw the focus of the American people back in the spring of 2001 when the U.S. government was already telling other governments around the world that we were going to be invading Afghanistan in October. Everybody else in the world knew it was coming. It was on the BBC. It was in Jane's Defense. It was all over the place. The only people not being told of the upcoming war were the American people. We were being conditized all the time. And then 9/11 happens exactly when the U.S. government needed it to anger the American people into supporting the war in Afghanistan and then later on the war in Iraq. So given the push for a new war in Iran, I find this sense of media distraction and tabloidization, if you will. It's a little disconcerting, and it's kind of a warning sign. So anyway, turning to the news here, obviously the economy continues to deteriorate. And actually, I'm going to take a moment before we get into that, a reminder that our call-in number is 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. Matt is answering the phones and twiddling the dials in the control room today. The webcam is on. The chat window is open, so you can reach us through that way. And as always, you can email us as well at wrh@whatreallyhappened.com. Okay, got all the housekeeping stuff out of the way here. Now, yesterday, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation closed four more banks. The number of banks being closed on a weekly basis is continuing to accelerate. It was two banks a week ago. Yesterday, it was four banks. The Dow Jones Industrial Average hit a six-year low. And earlier in the week, I made a forecast that we're going to see the Dow down into the 6,000s by mid-March. May even happen sooner than that, but I'm going to stay with my original prognostication, as it were. Now, a couple of things. First of all, right now there is a flood of these phony notices from the Internal Revenue Service that are being spammed all over the email. And you get it, and there's this attached form, and it says, please fill out this attached form. You may qualify for this or that special credit, or, you know, if you wish to avoid investigation, fill out this stuff. And then they give you a number to fax it back to. And, you know, just a reminder, this is a phishing attack by identity thieves. This being tax season, they're using the IRS logos and everything. The IRS is already aware that this is going on. They're trying to track these people down right now, but this is going on. If you get any kind of notice from the IRS in the email, it is bogus. They don't use email. They certainly do not ask you to send information in via email. And fax. I mean, they've got the electronic filing system, or you can go down to your local office if you wish to deal with them, and I know a lot of people don't want to. But these email notices with a fax number, these are absolute hoaxes. Now, one other thing to be aware of, some credit card companies are beginning to send out these little notifications of a change of service. And they look like ads, and a lot of people might be tempted to just toss them without reading them. But you need to read all of the communications from the credit card companies right now because they're trying to change the rules. And the one that I got from one of our credit card companies yesterday said that we are raising everybody's rates to cover, you know, basically to cover their losses, and up to an absolutely usurious, like 29%. Interest rate on the credit card balances. And they said, you have the option to voluntarily close your credit card account, at which point you'll be allowed to pay off the balance at your current interest rate. Obviously, this is a credit card we don't have that much of a balance on, so I'm going to exercise this option rather than get socked for all these additional interest charges. But we've made all of our payments. We've made all of our payments, and looking at this little notice that we got, this is something that was mass mailed to everybody. And I think the plan here is they're kind of hoping that people will just sort of discard it without reading it because it looks like it's an ad, you know, for some other kind of a program. But you need to read it very carefully, all of this stuff. And I think probably a lot of these credit card companies are going to do this. The goal isn't to get you to shut down your account. They're basically trying to sneak a rate increase in on everybody, but under the law, they have to give you the option of opting out of the credit card. So pay attention to these things. And yeah, this might be the time to stop, to get rid of some of your credit cards, especially if it's a low balance card like this one was. Some of our credit card companies have actually halved the minimum monthly payment rather than risk people going to default. And that's been a tremendous blessing. And obviously, that's a company I'm going to continue to do business with. But this other card, they just lost a customer because I'm definitely opting out on this stuff. And you just need to be paying attention to all of these little notices you're getting. Now, yesterday, in the New York Times op-ed, columnist David Brooks wrote this article, Money for Idiots, which basically tried to sell this idea that we, all Americans, are in this financial mess together, that we should not feel hostility toward Wall Street or the bankers because, after all, they're suffering just as much as we are, as the government takes trillions of dollars from the ordinary working class people and showers it all over the banking institutions. And we're starting to see more and more of these puff pieces where they're trying to say that what is good for these ultra-rich bankers and Wall Street investors is really what's good for America, and it is complete and utter nonsense. You know, these are the guys who turned the stock market into a giant open-air casino and ran up trillions in dollars of derivative debt that really wasn't a real debt, like they loaned money and needed to get it back. It was a roll of the dice and playing the odds, and they ran up these huge derivatives debts with some very unrealistic gambling odds, if you will, and now they're trying to stick the American people with the bill. And I think certainly looking at, well, like the thing just now with the credit card, yeah, we have a right to feel hostile when we're being taken advantage of. When they come in and they set up a set of rules and we say, okay, we're going to play by your rules, and then they change the rules and say, oh, you owe us much more money now. You know, so sell us your firstborn male child and we'll take the money and go into South African zinc or something like that. Looking at the way this article, and there have been many like it, is trying to convince us that we really should be kind and gentle to those people who are foreclosing on our homes and businesses and so forth, reminds me of those college hazing rituals where the guy stands there and he's getting whacked on the backside with a paddle and says, you know, thank you, sir, may I have another? Boom. Thank you, sir, may I have another? Boom. That's sort of, I think, what they're trying to get the American people into, this idea of taking all this abuse and saying, you know, thank you, Your Highness, may I have another one? Or thank you, Caesar, or whatever it is we're supposed to be saying as we continue to be abused. Now, getting into the area of the torture scandal, we're seeing all this going back and forth about the torture issue. We are seeing very little indication from the Barack administration that they're interested in the rule of law or treaty obligations or even the Constitution. But I think one of the most craven examples of governmental cowardice has come from north of the border up in Canada, where their foreign affairs minister, Maxime Bernier, basically came out Saturday complaining about an official Canadian document regarding being able to recognize torture in other regimes. And it listed the United States and Israel on the list of countries that engage in torture. And this Bernier saying, horrors, that's wrong. It must be rewritten. We can't include our close allies on the list of countries that torture. And so I'm trying to find out now, what is the Canadian word for pussy? Because that's what this guy is, to roll over like that. We're going to take a break here. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Visit us online at whatreallyhappened.com. And now, set your eyes on the future and let's consider what really happened.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show. Our phone number is 800-259-9231. If you're watching through the webcam, we're starting to get into the morning light out here on the island of Oahu. And it looks like it's going to be a fairly lovely day and very, very cold. I mean, relative to Hawaii. I realize we're not cold in that, you know, you have to go up to the very tops of the volcanoes to see snow and ice or anything. But it really is a very, very cool spring. And which is great, because that way my lovely wife Claire, she just sort of snuggles up to me a little bit more in the middle of the night, which I kind of appreciate. Now, on the last segment, we were talking about torture and the Canadian government's just absolute horror that one of their own official documents lists Israel and the United States as using torture. And, you know, it's this sort of daydream world of politics where reality just doesn't intrude anymore. You know, it's impolite to say the truth. You know, we're all diplomats. You know, we're not supposed to say what's really going on in the world. Now, speaking of diplomats and international relationships, a reminder that the United States government is bound by treaty obligation to investigate and prosecute torture crimes carried out by its own citizenry and government. It's in the treaty. And if you read the Constitution, treaties are the supreme law of the land. In many cases, you know, if there is a conflict between the treaty and the U.S. Constitution itself, the treaty obligations will supersede. That is the highest law of the land. So we're bound by treaty to prosecute these torture crimes, and of course, we're not. We're getting the big ho-hum. We're getting the Barack Obama administration is saying, well, you know, some bad things happen, but we have to move forward, and we don't wish to be divisive. We're now hearing that the Barack Obama administration is now taking the position that the captured enemy combatants, or whatever euphemism they're using today, are still not covered by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. They may not use the civil courts to challenge their imprisonment in these prisons they're expanding in Afghanistan. Yes, Obama's closing Guantanamo. But those people inside are not being released. They're being sent to a new facility being built in Afghanistan. This is why I'm calling Obama our token president, because everything he does to keep his election promises is a token gesture at best. And that's all it is. Obama is absolutely standing side by side with the Bush policy of keeping these people in prison and not allowing them any due process whatsoever. We are hearing that President Bush directly threatened the government of Britain to keep information about U.S. torture secret. We know they've been waterboarding. We know waterboarding is a torture. We know that something far worse probably happened, because a lot of these people died in U.S. custody. They were tortured to death. The exact mechanism, we don't know. We don't need to know. We know they were being tortured. We know they died. That's all we need to know. We should be moving forward to prosecutions. If we are a republic, which is supposed to be ruled by law, then nobody's allowed to torture in this society, not even the President of the United States. Now, we're also hearing that the Obama administration is not pursuing prosecutions against CIA officers who were engaged in these torture operations on these various captured prisoners, some of whom were absolutely innocent. We reported on the case not too long ago about a guy in Iraq. He was a taxi driver. That's what he did. He drove a cab, and he got grabbed by a bunch of Iraqi military who were working, you know, they wanted the reward money. They grab this guy, they beat him up, they tie him up, they take him to the U.S. and say, oh, yes, this is an al-Qaeda terrorist. Give us our money. And the U.S. gives these guys the reward money. And they take this taxi driver and they send him to Guantanamo. And he gets tortured. And he's done nothing wrong. We're torturing innocent people. Some of these Iraqis were tortured to find the weapons of mass destruction, which we now know never existed. Our president lied us into this war in Iraq because of weapons of mass destruction, and the torturer said, well, we're going to torture these people until we find those weapons of mass destruction. So you can imagine being an Iraqi, and you're being tortured for information you can't possibly have. And you keep saying, there are no weapons, and they won't believe you, and they go on torturing you, or worse, and we know this happened on at least one occasion, they're torturing your kid and making you watch. But remember, they only hate us because we're free. Oh, my goodness. There was an incident earlier this week. Apparently, there was an incident where Russia actually fired on and sank a Chinese cargo ship over a trade dispute. 8 people are feared dead. Fortunately, this doesn't seem to be escalating into anything. Unlike the situation in Iran, we are hearing from both Benjamin Netanyahu, who's going to be the new prime minister of Israel, and we're hearing from Barack Obama that it is urgent that action be taken against Iran. And today's statement, or rather yesterday's statement from the White House, is accusing Iran of reneging on its international obligations. Now, I want to hit this phrase very hard. International obligations. What obligations are really in effect here? Well, let's go back to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which Iran has signed and the United States has signed. Remember what I said just a few minutes ago, in the Constitution of the United States, treaties are the supreme law of the land. So Iran has signed the NNPT, the United States has signed the NNPT. Flipping through the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, we come to Article 4. Article 4 says, parties to the treaty in a position to do so shall also cooperate in contributing alone or together with other states or international organizations to the further development of the applications of nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, especially in the territories of non-nuclear weapon states party to the treaty, with due consideration for the needs of the developing areas of the world. What this means, this is a treaty the U.S. government has signed. Not only is the United States government obligated to allow Iran to build power stations and the fuel rods for same, but the United States is obligated to help them do it. We're supposed to be there on the ground helping them to build their power station, which, by the way, is a really great way to make sure they're not building weapons. Because if you're in there building the power station, you know what they're doing. You're helping them do it. That's the reason this clause is in there. Because if Iran wants to build a power station, and we all say, great, that's you're allowed to do that, we're going to come in and help, then there's no possibility of a clandestine weapons laboratory underneath the Iranian power station, like the one they've got under Dimona in Israel. So in the area of this claim of reneging on international obligations, it's the United States that has reneged on its international obligations. The U.S. government is in violation of treaty. That is the ultimate international crime. Wars start that way, which is what the U.S. wants. They want a war to distract us from the economy. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Welcome to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program. Call Mike now at 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231.
And remember, the more you call in, the less you have to listen to me talking. Oh, my goodness, the phones are lighting up like a Christmas tree. We're going to go to Todd in Ohio. Aloha, Todd. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hello, Mike. Just wanted to touch on something I continue to see anytime there's a financial article or somebody commenting on the cause of the current financial crisis or meltdown. I don't know if you've noticed this, but I continue to notice that they always focus on the housing bubble or the subprime, which generally is another way of referring to the subprime mortgage bubble. Well, I did some research over the in the last few days, and here are some figures I thought I would throw out for everyone to consider. Now, the first is that total mortgage debt in 2008, the highest figure, estimated figure I could find on the net, was $14 trillion. Now, the subprime mortgage debt is only a small part of that total mortgage debt. The highest figure I could find, 2008 figure I could find for the subprime mortgage debt, is $1.4 trillion. Now, compare those two figures, $14 trillion in overall mortgage debt, $1.4 trillion in the subprime mortgage debt. Compare those two figures with the derivatives bubble. Now, if you do some research, try to find the estimates of what the derivatives bubble was in 2008. The most conservative figure I found is 1,000 trillion. In other words, a quadrillion. Now, could that be why these mainstream people in the mainstream press always focus on just the housing bubble and never even mention the word derivatives, since by focusing just on the housing bubble, they can pretend or give the impression that somehow this has at least as much, if not more, to do with all of these struggling workers taking out mortgages they couldn't afford, pretending that they're as much at fault for this as the bankers, when in reality, the derivatives bubble is entirely the creation of people like Bernard Madoff and Henry Paulson, people taking out mortgages. They had nothing to do with that derivatives bubble.
That's absolutely correct. The corporate media is attempting to put the blame onto the people for what's going on. But as you pointed out, the entire subprime mortgage issue was a trillion and a half. We've already spent five times that amount, or the government has already borrowed on our behalf and spent five times that amount, and they have yet to address it. Remember when TARP went through, they said, we're going to buy up all those toxic assets. And then as soon as it passed, no, we're not going to buy up those toxic assets. We're going to do direct capital injection. And then all of a sudden, the CEOs were off to their resorts having parties and giving themselves retention awards and all the rest of that stuff. You're absolutely correct. I think this underscores the fact that the subprime mortgage is being scapegoated to cover for failed government and economic policy. The initiating event for all of this was the Bush administration handing tax credits to corporations to make it easier to send high-paying American jobs to other countries. Prior to that, Americans were making the mortgage payments. They were making the credit card payments. They were making the car loan payments. Everything was fine until the jobs got taken away and sent to other countries. That was the initiating event that triggered the cascade that we're seeing now. So now the government is realizing they screwed up. And they realize the American people understand that this is all the government's fault. So they're trying to, it's like this puff piece in the New York Times about how, well, the rich are in the mess along with the rest of us, and we shouldn't be hostile towards them. You know, they're trying to find a scapegoat, and they're trying to put the blame on the subprime mortgage borrowers who were only taking advantage of the very attractive offers that were being made to them by the financing companies. But you're right, the subprime mortgage is a tiny, tiny fraction of the problem. What they should do with the derivatives debt is just declare it null and void, because
right,
it's not a real debt. The money doesn't exist in the first place.
Right. They're gambling bets.
That's exactly
now,
right.
Why should the taxpayers be forced to pay for the gambling bets of Wall Street scam artists like Bernard Madoff and Henry Paulson?
Well, we shouldn't, and we're about to stand up and say, no, we're not going to pay for it, which is why all of a sudden there's this big push to find some way to disarm America, and yes, you're allowed to have guns under the Constitution, but by golly, we're going to stop selling you the bullets. That's the newest scam they're trying to pull.
Right, and one final point. I sent you an email several weeks ago. I don't know if you got it, but where I linked to that thread that I said I created in the Prison Planet forum, in which I lay all this out in more detail. But again, I just want to add, but since you have new listeners, I'll just suggest what my idea for how to reform the system is very briefly, and then let you put give your own thoughts. But it's two key reforms. We must put all of these derivatives, infected derivatives, saturated mega banks through Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and in the reorganization proceedings, wipe out, like you say, all their derivatives because they're invalid contracts to begin with. And then number two is to replace our debt-based money system, fractional reserve-based money system, with a debt-free money system. And the particular kind of debt-free system that I advocate is one in which you have a U.S. Treasury currency issued debt-free and interest-free to fund public infrastructure. But that's what makes me a greenbagger, and then I don't want to waste a lot of time with the greenbagger versus gold bug debate. But that's how I would solve it. So,
well, that would be a good solution. John F. Kennedy tried to do that just before he got himself killed. Before you go, Todd, though, let me ask you real quick. Without actually giving me your email address, are you using Hotmail by any chance?
No, I sent it from a Yahoo.com address.
Oh, okay.
It's actually from Single Tax is my handle.
Okay. Would you resend that to me again? We've been having some email issues. We're finding out from a lot of people on Hotmail accounts that email to whatreallyhappened.com is bouncing back to them. So either something is broken or we're being interfered with or some other such thing. So please resend that to me, and I'll definitely put it up. But you're absolutely correct. This nation was started with a monetary system of a fixed unit of value. The dollar is actually a weight measure of silver. And then all of a sudden, we had this crash of 1904, which made the creation of a central bank necessary, and that's how the Federal Reserve got rammed through, and Woodrow Wilson signed it as part of his deal to become president. And he wrote after the fact, "I have just destroyed my own country." And he was absolutely true. And then that same year, we got the 16th Amendment was claimed to have been ratified. There is reason to think that that was also a lie, like Saddam's nuclear bombs. And ever since then, we've been sinking more and more into debt because there the critical flaw, the key enslavement mechanism of the Federal Reserve, debt-based monetary system, is the instant it goes into operation, more money is owed to the Federal Reserve than is actually in existence. And
right.
That was the trap that was set for the United States.
That's one aspect of the trap. The other aspect is that if everyone got out of debt, the money supply would vanish because it was all created out of debt. Whereas if you had a debt-free money supply, then you would have a permanent money supply that's non-collapsible. But that's the key point, though, is if everyone got out of debt, there would be no money supply, and yet there would be countless billions in outstanding interest debt still hanging
that's
over
exactly
everyone's
right.
head.
That's right. Exactly right. That's why this system has to collapse at some point, and I think it's getting ready to do it now. The big question is, out of this collapse, what are the political opportunists and scam artists going to try and shove down our throats next? You know, they used the crash of 29 to end the gold standard and basically make the Federal Reserve note the only currency that was legal in the United States. What are they getting ready to do with this collapse? And, you know, after 1904, they pulled the U.S. out of the Depression with World War I. After the crash of 29, they pulled the U.S. out of the Depression with World War II. Look at how hard they're trying to start a war in Iran. Okay. Todd, we got to let you go. We're taking another break here for some commercials. Thank you very much for the phone call, and please call in again. And, yeah, send me back that that information about your two-step solution because I agree with it. All right, we're going to stop here. I'm going to sip some more of this Kona coffee my wife just made for me, and we'll be back in a few minutes with some more news and wrapping up the first hour of our show. We'll be right back.
Can we talk?
Can we talk?
Can we talk about gun control?
Gun control?
Seems like it should work, doesn't it?
It should work.
You'd think so. Yeah.
Pass the right laws.
Pass the right laws.
And you can disarm the criminals.
You disarm them.
That's the idea.
But the problem is...
The problem?
criminals don't obey the law.
They don't obey the law.
That's true.
After all, they're criminals.
They're criminals.
Criminals. They'll always find a way to get guns.
No matter how many laws you pass.
Which means
they still have guns.
They still have guns. While the rest of us...
The rest of us?
The rest of us are just left defenseless.
When all this twisted steel was swept away, did these remaining holes reveal what really happened?
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here, and we're talking about... Well, we're bouncing around a lot today. We're talking about the economy mostly. We're talking about the push into Iran. The two are linked, as I was saying at the end of the last segment. The United States went into a depression in 1904. The depression was used by financial interests to help bring about the creation of the Federal Reserve and the launching of the personal income tax via the 16th Amendment, which may or may not have been ratified. According to Judge James C. Fox in Sullivan versus United States, it wasn't actually ratified. This is a federal judge in an official court transcript, by the way. And, of course, the Federal Reserve Act was passed over a Christmas break by a handful of congresspeople who waived the quorum rule, voted it through. Woodrow Wilson signed it, keeping one of the promises he made in exchange for the campaign donations to win the presidency. And he wrote in his own diary, "I've destroyed my own country." And... you know, almost immediately thereafter, we were in World War One. And we've only just now found out that there was a huge lie involved in World War One. Now, researchers have known this for quite some time, but the official story was that the German U-boats sank the Lusitania. It was a poor, innocent passenger ship. Americans were on board, and therefore we had to go defend our honor by waging war on Germany. And my grandfather was in that war. He lost a lung to German mustard gas. I still have the gas mask supplied by the lowest bidder that failed him, and his helmet. One of these days I'll find a worthy museum to donate that all to. Then, of course, we had, just only 2 months ago, divers went down to the wreck of the Lusitania. And by the way, I didn't realize this. There was actually an operation by the British government to demolish the wreck on the ocean floor on the theory that it was a hazard to navigation. They wanted to basically just erase it, blot it out. But that didn't work out. Divers on the wreck have now confirmed that the Lusitania was, in fact, carrying military supplies and munitions to Great Britain. And that made it a legitimate target of war. And more to the point, there have been indications throughout the years that the U.S. government leaked the carrying of munitions on this ship to Germany in order to goad them into torpedoing the boat so that the U.S. would then have a cause with which to enter World War One. Then we skip forward to the crash of 29, and the U.S. is struggling through most of the 30s with a horrendous depression. And we find out, because of documents declassified in 1994, that Franklin Roosevelt not only knew the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor, just sitting out my window here to the left, but that he had deliberately goaded them into it by following an 8-step plan written up by Office of Naval Intelligence Lieutenant Commander Arthur H. McCollum. Starting a year earlier, in October of 1940, they started following these 8 steps to so anger the Japanese that the Japanese would have to attack the United States. The reason was simple. Japan had signed the Axis Agreement with Italy and Germany. And if Japan could attack the U.S., could be lured into attacking the U.S., then the U.S. could enter the war against Hitler, which is what Roosevelt really wanted to do, and get us out of that depression. So here we are. We're in another economic crisis. They're saying it's the worst crisis since the Great Depression, could easily go past it. And we are already seeing wars started with lies, the lies about Iraq's nuclear weapons. Now it lies about Iran's nuclear ambitions when they are, in fact, only conforming to a treaty which both the U.S. and Iran has signed. Iran is simply exercising its legal right. But our leadership is looking back at how world wars got us out of two major economic messes before. And the conventional wisdom is, well, let's do it again. We can't think of anything better to do. We can't think of another way to save the economy because the people who wound up with the money, they're not going to give it back. And the people we're trying to suck more money out of don't have any more. So let's just have a war and solve the mess that way. And that is the thinking. And if they succeed, then a lot of young Americans who have done no wrong in this world are going to wind up carrying rifles and breathing depleted uranium dust. And I'm hoping that we can stop that. And if it means that the United States must follow the USSR into the dustbin of history, I'm okay with that. That's preferable to another world war with tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people dying just to protect the wealth of a few greedy bastards. Now, turning back to the more tactical level of things, according to the London Daily Telegraph, Israel has been carrying out assassinations of Iranian nuclear scientists. Now, by any reasonable definition of the word, this is acts of terror. Under the USA Patriot Act, if you are threatening or carrying out violence against somebody in order to get them to change their direction on a given policy or issue, that is defined as an act of terror. So Israel is carrying out acts of terror in Iran right now. So Israel is justifying it by saying not that Iran has nuclear weapons now, because they can't prove it any more than they could prove that Iraq had nuclear weapons. And following that embarrassment, they've changed strategy. They're not going to say that Iran actually has nuclear weapons. No. The justification for going in and killing them all is that they might have nuclear weapons somewhere down the road. Now, I'm sorry, this is like taking little girls and sewing up their nether regions because they might want to be prostitutes somewhere down the road. It really doesn't make a lot of sense, and of course it's going to annoy the young girls. And what happens if Israel decides that somebody in the U.S. might in the future do something Israel doesn't like? Does Israel have the right to come into the United States and start assassinating people they don't like? Because if Israel thinks it's okay to do it to Iran, they're going to think it's okay to do it everywhere else. The United States, Great Britain, Canada, Australia. And if it's wrong for Israel to carry out assassinations inside the United States, then it's wrong for Israel to be carrying out assassinations in Iran. You cannot have it both ways. Now, speaking of Israel and spying, the Lebanese government arrested an Israeli spy. Apparently he's been a spy for Israel for about 25 years, and they've arrested him for involvement in the assassination of the Hezbollah leader, Imad Magud, I'm going to probably mispronounce this, Magudniyev. Okay. And they've arrested this guy as possibly being behind the assassination. And you probably read in the media the last week, Israel's very concerned about potential retaliations for the assassination of this gentleman, all the more so now because they've arrested a Mossad agent in connection with this. But here's the really good part about this. The guy they just arrested as a 25-year Mossad agent and assassin for Israel operating inside Lebanon is the cousin of one of the men that was accused of being a hijacker on 9/11. It's just one more indication that 9/11, there may have been more to that than the official story would give us. Remember, the five people who were arrested on 9/11 itself, on the day of the attack, five people were arrested, the dancing Israelis with the white van, and they were high-fiving each other, and they were using a moving company as the front. And Pacifica Radio, a little later, identified three of them as Mossad agents. And they were cheering and having a wonderful old time. And then we had Carl Cameron's four-part story on Fox News about the Israeli spy ring that was in the process of being rolled up when 9/11 happened. And a U.S. official said, well, there's evidence that links these Mossad agents to 9/11, but the U.S. government classified it. So a lot of people have been very suspicious that the attack on the World Trade Towers was a repeat of the Levant affair, in which U.S. and British targets in Israel were being bombed by Israeli agents and evidence planted to frame a third party. Same thing with the USS Liberty. If that ship had sunk, they were going to blame Egypt for it. Same with the USS Cole, probably. So, another Mossad link. All right, that's the end of hour one of our show. We're going to be taking a break here for some news. When we come back, we'll be in hour two. So, call in, and until we see you in a few minutes, Aloha, America.
Radio program.
And Aloha America, welcome back to hour two of our show today. Special shout out to all of our affiliates who join us for the second hour. During the first hour, obviously, we're talking about the economy. We're talking about the continuing push to start a war in Iran or anywhere for that matter. I don't think it's so much Iran is the issue. It certainly is for Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu is already saying his first action as the new prime minister of Israel is going to be to deal with Iran and drag the U.S. along with him into a war that will probably include Russia on the other side. But it is hard to imagine why the U.S. government would be looking at entering a new war now from the practical side. I know why they're doing it. We got out of the Depression of 1904 by going into World War I. We got out of the crash of 29 and the Depression through the 30s by getting into World War II. Our economy is in really serious trouble, and the conventional wisdom in Washington, D.C. is, well, you know, it worked before. Let's start a war. We can't think of anything better to do to get the economy going again, because the people who wound up with the money and all of the debt obligations, they're not going to give it back. And the people that we go to get more money, the working class people, they're broke. So we're kind of stuck here. It's all breaking down. Let's have a good old war as a distraction. And let's have the media bring back JonBenet Ramsey and Chandra Levy. And I notice right now I'm watching one of the corporate media channels, and they're going on about how those mean, nasty men are out there taking advantage of young women over the internet and tabloid stuff like that, because they don't want to talk about the economy. They don't want to talk about the push for, and they don't want to talk about the things that really affect your life. But I think this idea that we can solve our problems with another world war is not going to work. And the reason is very, very simple. In the years leading up to World War I and in the years leading up to World War II, the United States was a manufacturing powerhouse. We had all the factories that made ball bearings and gears and engines and cars and trucks and TVs. We made things. We were a manufacturing titan. And when the global wars broke out and we got suckered into them, it was very easy to convert these factories into making the materials necessary to support a war. That situation doesn't exist anymore. Over the last 30 years, we've allowed our manufacturing base to erode. A lot of those factories that used to make American products, they're closed down. The equipment has been stripped off, sold in many cases to foreign countries. The buildings are rusting, corroding, they're falling apart. At the close of World War II, there were 30 companies in the United States making TV sets. There are none left today. Our big three automakers are in serious trouble. They're shutting factories down. General Motors is moving their operations to Brazil. If we get into a major global war right now, we are going to lose it. And we're going to lose it because we don't have the manufacturing capacity that can be quickly diverted into providing the volume of war material that is necessary. Talk to any experienced soldier. Not these wannabes walking around talking about strategy and tactic. The real professional soldiers talk about logistics. Just getting your material to the front lines is a major challenge. You go through material support like it was water. Bullets, tanks, trucks during Vietnam. Look at all the helicopters we lost. We've lost over 1,000 vehicles in Iraq since we theoretically won that conflict in 2003. We've lost 1,000 vehicles. Sustaining that kind of production, we're not able to do that right now. And we certainly don't have an economy that can absorb that kind of cost any longer. And nobody else in the rest of the world wants to loan us any more money. They're starting to pull back and say, we're not sure that you can get the American people to pay off all these bills because they can't pay the bills they've got now. So there's some very reckless decision-making going on in Washington. And as I was telling Alex Jones earlier in the week, I'm completely disappointed and disgusted with Barack Obama. I'm not saying John McCain would have been any better. It's obvious both of them serve the same masters. But his handling of the economic crisis is absolutely, absolutely wrong. You don't rob from the poor to give to the rich. This whole economic crisis began because high-paying American jobs were sent to other countries with huge tax credits by the government. They're looking for a scapegoat to blame, whether it's the subprime mortgage or whatever. They're looking for somebody to blame. But the blame rests squarely on the government of the United States that, for whatever reason, decided they were going to give tax credits to corporations to make it easier to send American jobs to other countries. Prior to that, Americans were paying their mortgage. They were paying their credit cards. They were paying their car loans. It was all working. And then the jobs got taken away and it all collapsed. The working class of America was the foundation on which the entire economy rested. Somehow, through serious cultural blindness, we developed a governmental and corporate culture that thought the economy could be made to run without manufacturing. It's never worked in history. It certainly wasn't going to work today, because all those people down there working in the factories, those are the customers. And that noise you hear, there's another big military helicopter going overhead right now. They've been doing that a lot, rattling the windows and stuff. Anyway, moving on here, we're getting into a situation more and more the government is obviously worried that Americans are getting upset. We're getting angry. We have a right to be angry. And they're trying to find ways to protect themselves. We know they've got those pain ray guns on the Hummers that they're getting ready to park around all of us dissenters. They're more and more starting to treat dissent as a crime. Some of the protesters from last year's Republican National Convention are facing felony charges. The U.S. government has taken to calling anybody who dissents an extremist, which is kind of a fuzzy term without a real legal definition. What is an extremist? But there's they're all extremists. Well, yeah, we are. We're extremists. And the function of an extremist in our society is to set the boundaries on the political debate. So we'll say, yes, we should shoot alien space invaders on sight. And it sounds absurd, but then you pull back to the middle and say, okay, but let's at least talk about what would happen if one actually came down and opened up the door and came out and said, take me to your leader. And out of the old understanding and worldview and the extremist limits, you start finding a path into the future. And I deliberately chose a very absurd example. But I think we're at that point right now where we need to seriously start thinking past the end of the United States government, because I personally am convinced it's going to go the way of the USSR. And I think the reason for all of this bailout, which is taking trillions of dollars on the public tab and giving it to all these very rich people, they're looting the country is what they're doing. I really think that's what's going on. They're going to loot the country, put it in their pockets, and head for the borders as everything crashes behind them. And we need to start thinking about what we're going to do with this country after they're gone. We need to study how the Russians dealt with the collapse of the USSR. We need to study what they did, what worked, what didn't work. How do we kick out the oligarchs the same way that Putin did? Because we're going to have to do that at some point. And we need to start making those plans, because we don't want to be caught completely unprepared if the U.S. government collapses the way the USSR did. So I don't know about you. I can't see a way for them to continue much longer, not the way they're running the economic policy. They're pushing in exactly the wrong direction. And this idea that if they collapse the American economy and they're going to sell us a new globalist vision of control, that's going to be a tough sell, because right now everybody's looking at globalism as the reason we are in this mess. And selling us more globalism as the cure out of it, nobody's going to buy that. Why are we going to buy more of what got us into this mess? The reason the entire world is facing a depression is because those natural safety barriers of national borders got taken down. And what happened in the U.S. is dragging everybody else down. We're going to stop here and take a break. If you'd like to join us on the air, 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. Matt is in the control room answering the phones. When we come back, we're going to talk about the latest effort to disarm the American people by a government that is obviously terrified of us. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
You're listening to the Genesis Communications Network. And now, set your eyes on the future and let's consider what really happened.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. We've been talking about the economy. We're talking about the push for war because our government, frankly, can't think of anything better to do. And behind it all, of course, is the specter of all the rioting and protests we're seeing all over Europe and the rest of the world. And I think that's one of the reasons why the American corporate media is trying so hard to revive stories about Chandra Levy and JonBenet Ramsey and the Tylenol scandal and all these old, old stories that really don't have any more legitimacy for today, because they don't want to report what's going on in these other countries. They don't want to talk about how the government of Iceland was brought down. They don't want to talk about how close governments in some other countries are to being brought down by economically inspired riots in their own country. We are seeing clear indications that our own government is basically acting for the preservation of its own self and its own privilege and its own power, and to heck with the Constitution in the process. We're seeing more and more calls for controls on the Internet and the alternative media. It's always couched in terms of, you know, those child abusing people out there using the Internet, and of course always the crackers and the identity thieves and the content pirates. And I'll agree, those are problems. And these criminals are wrecking things for the rest of us. Identity theft cost something like $48 billion last year. But what we're seeing the government do is using these real concerns to justify controlling those portions of the Internet which are not engaged in any illegal activity, but which are venues for the exposure of governmental and corporate corruption. And a good example of that is Usenet. Now, for those of you who are too young to remember, when the Internet first came into being, when the ARPANET turned into the Internet following the Great Revolt, there was no web. There were no browsers. There was no HTML. The Internet consisted of electronic mail, file transfer, and Usenet. And Usenet was a news group system where there were all these different news groups of different topics. Some were moderated, some were not. And anybody could post articles into these Usenet news groups, and anybody could download them. And it was all, the downloaders were anonymous. The people who posted stuff, there'd be identifying information, but people were downloading the stuff anonymously because it was being propagated throughout the Internet uniformly, which was in keeping with the Internet's original design philosophy that it could survive the loss of large parts of its structure and continue to operate. So there was no centralized collection point for the Usenet stories. It was just everything flowing in every direction at the same time. And it became, before the web came along, before there was what really happened, Usenet is where people who were concerned about trends in the government and cover-ups were sharing information back and forth. Well, the U.S. government can't shut down the World Wide Web. There's too much money being made on it. It's become a taxing revenue, a source of tax revenue. But last year, citing child porn and content piracy, the entire Usenet was shut off. Not just the groups where the music pirates were posting binary files. Not just the child pornography sites. They shut everything down. The recipe group, the ship model building group, the aviation groups, the health and safety groups, the gay rights group, everything was shut down under the excuse that we were protecting people from child porn. And it's a classic case of government heavy-handed actions against freedom of speech using any flimsy excuse that they can. And we're going to start seeing it here where they're going to start talking. They're already talking about literally licensing websites the way they do TV stations. So instead of all of us having our own little individual websites and our blogs and so forth, they're now going to say you have to have a license to be putting content on the World Wide Web. And obviously the licenses will go to the existing corporate media who are already screaming and whining and crying that they're losing audience to the alternative media. Well, the reason they're losing the audience to alternative media is we're sick of being lied to. People are coming to this radio show. They're coming to What Really Happened. They're going to Alex Jones because they're tired of being fed BS about Saddam's nuclear bombs. I mean, the bottom line is, when that whole mess was going down, the TV networks were selling that story as hard as they could. And, you know, I went to one of our local network affiliates to try and do an interview, and I said, I want to ask you, where was the watchdog on government abuse function that you all claim that you're doing? You know, you reported these lies. And they said, oh, no, no, we didn't lie. We merely reported what the White House said. And I said, aren't you supposed to question that? And they go, oh, no, we can't do that. Which means the corporate media is just a propaganda device here. So we're seeing this push to control us all, to control our freedom of speech, to confine us to free speech zones. And the latest one, and this shows you how terrified they're getting. We just had a recent Supreme Court ruling that affirmed that the right to keep and bear arms is an individual right granted to all American citizens. And we know because the Second Amendment talks about the security of a free state that what they're talking about are military arms. They're not talking about target shooting. They're not talking about hunting. They're talking about military arms. We, the people, have a constitutional right to own and possess arms equivalent to those available to the standing army of the United States government. Why? Because that is the best defense against a dictatorship taking root in this country. All dictators ban guns, or they find some other way to get around it. Apparently, because the Supreme Court has reaffirmed the Second Amendment, the new plan is to ban ammunition. Second Amendment says you have a right to keep and bear arms. Doesn't say anything about the bullets. That's the new spin. We're getting word from sources inside the State Department saying that they're trying to float a trial balloon to see if people would sit still for ammunition being banned. And they're banning specifically the type of ammunition that would be used in a civil insurrection against a government that has grown way too big for its britches. So they're going to be banning the 7.62 by 39 millimeter Soviet, 7.62 51 millimeter NATO rounds, 308 Winchester, that's a hunting round, by the way, 5.56 NATO, and the 223 Remington. And, you know, they're talking about banning the 6.8 millimeter SPC, the 9 millimeter Parabellum, the 40 Smith & Wesson, and the 45 ACP. In other words, handgun ammo. Yes, you can have all the guns that you want. You just don't have to let the bullets come in here. That is their current plan. So for those of you who realize that the government isn't kidding around about starting a depression, stockpile the ammo, set up your own loading bench, because you're going to have to be making your own ammunition here. And I know this sounds very extreme to be saying this, but, you know, look what happened in Romania. The people got pushed to the point where they had to fight back. And, you know, gun bans never reduce crime. Crime goes up in a gun ban. The only reason to disarm the people. The government's treating the people like the enemy, and that means the government is the enemy of the people. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to be talking to John from Ohio and finding out what his view of the future may be. We'll be back.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Well, search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. We're going to go right to the phones. We've got John in Ohio. Aloha, John. What's on your mind today?
I'll try to pull it together. I heard you mention about we got to start thinking seriously about as this corporate economy, capitalist economy is collapsing and we're headed towards a total disaster and war, we need an alternative, not just militancy in the streets, which I think could be used very you know, for ulterior motives by the elite to declare martial law.
I agree.
And I believe that the one thing that is politically incorrect, the one thing that is taboo and unthinkable is the thing that we should start thinking about. And I don't belong to any organization, ever have, but I think the one thing that both the Patriot so-called movement that does great work on exposing the 9/11 inside job and the move towards martial law and the bankster globalization are schizophrenic in one sense, because they do great work there, but their great untouchable dirty word is socialism. And I think that this has to be considered, because unless we have at least an outline of an alternative, the elite will simply use this for dark ages of martial law and fascism. And I believe the source of their power is their ownership and control of all the real assets, as well as their of course their ability to print paper money. But all of the means of production and distribution is their source of power. And I think that
But that's the same thing you have under socialism. I mean, the state owned everything, and the state, you know, I mean, they always talked about the workers own everything, much as the way our own government talks about the taxpayers really own everything. But, you know, I mean, certainly as it was implemented by the USSR, socialism was a total mockery of the of whatever Marx was actually writing originally. So, considering that we're in a fascist economic model now, I disagree. I don't think socialism is the way to go. I think the kind of capitalism that we had when the United States was started, we need to go back to that and get away from this whole fiat debt-based monetary system.
Well, Michael, what I'm saying, though, is I don't think that that is historically or organically possible at this stage of history. The monopoly stage of bankster finance-dominated capitalism, I think, is an inevitable outcropping of the competition, the elimination and the competition into a greater and greater concentration and fewer hands in the internationalization of those monopoly capitalism. So I don't think we can go back in some kind of fairy tale to 200 years ago. What we have to do, I think, is have the people, the working class, black, white, blue collar, white collar, Jew, Gentile, whatever, join together to take for themselves. And I was reading historically, Daniel DeLeon, an American socialist during the early 20th century, had a kind of an outline for this, where the people would move into the factories that they're being locked out now by the millions, and just simply do what they do every day otherwise, but don't have any ownership or control, elect their representatives to all the various industries and services locally, and then their equivalent nationally in all the industries and services at an all-industrial coordinating Congress, and run it for themselves, subject to recall all of their elected representatives on an industrial basis. And I think this would solve any questions about democracy. At the same time, I believe the old Soviet Union was a deformed version of socialism.
There's no question about that. I think there's no question. I'm going to interrupt you here right now, because I understand it sounds kind of like an ideal situation here, but the problem with socialism is it will work only if every single individual member of your society is a selfless angel that works for the common good. Unfortunately, your basic human unit tends to be rather greedy and self-centered, and that is just human nature. It's a survival mechanism. It's why we're here, and the other pre-human hominids that we killed and ate are no longer here. And so the reality here is that socialism sounds really good in the sales pitch, but again, look how what happened with the Soviet Union. It created the most powerful ruling class in history, supposedly for the goal of creating a society without any class at all. All the Soviet Union really did was create a governmental system where the middle class was designed out right from the beginning. And that's the reason the USSR lasted as long as it did, because it is from the middle class that challenges to oligarchy always arise. That's why our own middle class is under such attack right now. We're going to switch to Alex in Minnesota, or is that Mississippi? I never get these abbreviations correct. Alex, aloha. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind? Is Alex not there? Going once, going twice. Okay, I guess Alex must have hung up. And so we're going to go back here and talk about some other things. Somebody wrote in to tell me that Usenet is actually still out there, and I know there's some private for-profit Usenet servers. The issue I'm having is that my ISP Roadrunner appears to be blocking all NNTP traffic going out to the web. So, again, it's just throwing out the baby with the bathwater. There was a lot of good groups on Usenet back when I was more into cooking recreationally. During my first marriage, I had a really nice kitchen with a lot of copper and a lot of brass. And I actually got to keep that during my first divorce. My first wife took everything except the dog and the kitchen. And I think because she forgot that we actually had one. So I used to do a lot of cooking, and I would go to Usenet to get a lot of my best recipes, especially ancient recipes, historical recipes. I was a big fan of that stuff. But that's all gone now, along with political discussion. And the government used the excuse of child porn and content piracy to justify shutting down that venue. And now they're going to come after the Internet. And we're already seeing all kinds of covert games being played. We're having all kinds of problems with email connectivity. Our servers have been under hacker attack almost nonstop so far this entire year here. Now, talking about the potential collapse or disruption of American society, we've talked before about the growing sovereignty movement. And what this is states are starting to pass bills reasserting their sovereignty under the United States Constitution. And what this means is that back when the United States was set up, the states had the authority. They were considered sovereign, independent entities legally. They were supposed to run their own internal affairs as they saw fit. They were joined in a confederation, if you will. And the role of the federal government was defined as arbitrating between the states. When you went across a state border, then you were in the jurisdiction of the federal government. Inside the states, the federal government was not supposed to tinker and tamper. Obviously, over the years, the federal government has very slowly and incrementally increased its influence over the states to the point where the federal government takes so much money out of the states and then turns around and says, if you want your money back, you will do what we say. And states are starting to fight back, especially the ones that are going broke. And they're saying, we're not going to send any more money to the federal government. We're going to keep it because we need it. And we're tired of the federal government refusing to give it back to us on various flimsy excuses. So we're seeing some 20 states have already passed these bills, basically saying that the federal government is limited to its constitutional role and may not expand that because of the 10th Amendment. And a lot of people are saying, well, this is just showboating and showcasing. It doesn't really mean anything. It means as much as the state's residents are willing to make it mean. And obviously the federal government is afraid of this growing movement because we're already seeing a tremendous amount of pressure being brought to bear on the state legislatures to table these resolutions or block them or otherwise prevent them from moving forward. We saw that in New Hampshire recently. But historically, this is how the American Civil War got started, where the state saying, wait a minute, we get to run our own business, and the growing federal government saying, no, we're in charge now. You do what we say. So we may be seeing the paperwork origins of a new civil war. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Visit us online at whatreallyhappened.com. And now, set your eyes on the future and let's consider what really happened.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the last segment of our show today. We're going to go right back to the phones. Keith in California. Aloha, Keith. Welcome to the show. What is on your mind today?
Hi, Mike. How you doing? I was just listening to the show, and you were talking about the sovereignty issue and the gun bullet ban issue. And here in California, the state seems to be expressing its right to the 10th Amendment. And it seems to me that we can also solve that problem with the bullet ban also. If the government, you know, continues with this trend, it seems I think more states will start joining that sovereignty deal.
Well, you know, what's interesting, back in the 1990s, there was actually a resolution making its way around the states called the Ultimatum Resolution. And it was very, very simple, that when the federal government debt went over $6 trillion, the federal government would be dissolved. And it was an attempt to impose some fiscal responsibility. Unfortunately, the necessary number of states to pass it, to force it into federal law, was not accomplished. But it does indicate that every once in a while the states start to, you know, strain at the chains, as it were. And I think under the current financial situation and the very obvious move toward dictatorship, you know, we are going to see more and more states do this. The problem is that most of the high-level officials in states themselves have federal ambitions. They don't want to be just the governor of a state. They want to become a president or a senator or whatever. And so very often you will find the upper leadership of a state is really thinking more in terms of their allegiances to the federal government rather than to their own state. We saw that certainly with Bill Clinton in Arkansas. We're seeing it to a lesser extent with Schwarzenegger in California.
Right.
And it, you know, and this is one of the reasons these things tend to stall, is because of the national level ambitions of the high state officials.
I agree.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. Have a good day.
You too.
All right, that was Keith in California, and, yeah, very cogent observation. When the country was set up and the states had the power, being governor of a state was considered far more prestigious than being a senator or a representative in Washington, D.C. Governor of a state was a full-time job, for one thing. Representative or senator in Washington, that was a part-time thing. You only met maybe 2-3 times a year. The rest of the time you went back to your states, and you worked with your local constituents, and the representatives were voted by the people, but the senators were appointed by the governor. That was how the governors exerted their control over the federal government. And then following the Civil War, some significant changes were made to our political structure. And over the course of time, you know, the federal government arrogated to itself the right to borrow money without the approval of the states, and really kind of put us on this path toward bankruptcy. It was all about greed and power. One of the reasons given for the assassination of Abraham Lincoln was that at the end of the war, he had planned to make amends for all of the unconstitutional things he had done by reverting the U.S. federal government back to its pre-Civil War constitution. This threatened a lot of people, including the newly emergent War Department and a much more powerful Congress that liked things just the way they were in the wake of the Civil War. And it is thought that this may have been one of the reasons for the conspiracy to assassinate Abraham Lincoln. And I know we've all been taught John Wilkes Booth, lone assassin, but the reality is that 6 people were convicted and executed for the conspiracy to kill Abraham Lincoln. There was a 7th who evaded punishment through the direct efforts of Secretary of War Edwin Stanton. So, a little bit of something odd going on over there. So as we get down here to the bottom of our show here, we're talking about the bullet ban. We're talking about a government that is obviously afraid of the people. and they're treating us like we're the enemy. They're putting cameras on every street corner. They're talking about having a camera on every street corner in time for the Chicago Olympics. They're watching us. They're reading our mail. They treat us like we're the enemy. And if the government is going to make the people, if they're going to treat the people like an enemy, then the government has become the enemy of the people. And that is the reality that we need to deal with right now. Government is supposed to be our partner in moving the nation forward. And instead, they've become this taskmaster that is flogging us for the last few dollars that we can fork over to shower on the people who ruined our economy. You know, an economy is very much like a building. Both are held up by that foundation that they're built on, that supports from underneath. Whether it's concrete in the case of a building or the working people of the nation is the foundation of our economy. And if you're going to move a building or move an economy, you got to pick it up from that foundation. If you try and pick a building up from the roof, that roof is going to tear off and the whole thing's going to crumble. But that's what Barack Obama is trying to do to the U.S. economy. He's trying to pick it up by the roof. He's taking money, borrowing money on our tab, $30,000 for every one of you listening to this show right now. That's what you're going to be expected to pay back in the coming years in taxes, for which you will receive no services, by the way. They're going to take that money, and they're pouring it onto the CEOs and the mortgage brokers and all those people who are crying they didn't make as much money as they thought they should have. And so they're looting the working people. And, you know, the caller in the first hour really nailed it right on the head. The total exposure for the subprime mortgage crisis was $1.5 trillion. We've already spent five times that. If we had taken $1.5 trillion and given it to the mortgage holders of the subprime mortgages to make up for the fact that we kicked their jobs into other countries, they would have paid off the mortgages. There would have been no mortgage crisis. There would have been no financial collapse. Instead, we get this ludicrous idea that we're going to take $1 trillion from the American people and give it to the banks so the banks can loan it back to the American people at interest, and that this is somehow going to make the economy move forward. It isn't. We're screeching to a halt here. They're not lowering taxes, which historically is the way that you get an economy moving again. They're refusing to do that. They're raising taxes. They're spending it on wooden arrow manufacturers. I mean, things like that. All right, one final story before the end of the show. We're gonna get out of politics and stuff. We're going to go into entertainment only because that's my day job. Apparently, the talks between the Hollywood actors and the producers have broken down again. Now, the Screen Actors Guild members are working without a contract right now. I think common sense says that we should not have another major strike. We're still recovering from the writer's strike that we had two seasons ago. That one really messed a lot of people. Oh, we've got another caller on the line. We're going to grab him real quick. Dave in California. Aloha, Dave. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind? Is Dave there? Going once. Oh, he dropped. Okay. All right. Well, the end of it. All right. So we're talking about the Hollywood actors and the producers. They're working without a contract. They're trying to get a contract put together. They're not meeting of the minds here. And I only have one piece of advice for my fellow entertainment people. And that is, right now, greed is not seen in a very positive light by the people who buy the tickets and buy the DVDs and subscribe to cable television. They're not going to respond positively to nitpicking over a few pennies here and there. And I think if there's another strike, we're going to see a lot of our entertainment start to come to us from other countries. And I have no problem with a wide variety of entertainment. We already have BBC America working in this country, but Hollywood at one point really was the center of the movie industry in the entire world, and it no longer is. There are wonderful production capabilities in England, Australia, China, India, and I think this grabbing and greed is not going to go across very well with the public, who may very quickly turn to alternative sources of content and movies. I think this is a time to really try and find a way through to something that works for everybody. Because another strike is really going to hurt the industry as a whole. It doesn't hurt the people at the top. They're very, very wealthy. They can survive it. But all those craftspeople, who actually do the nut and bolt work of making film and TV. They're the ones who pay the price for yet another strike. All right, that's it for our Saturday show, and we're going to take off here. We will be back Monday at 5 p.m. Central Time with more news, more mayhem, more calls. And thanks to everybody who did call in, because it does make the show a lot more entertaining. So, until Monday, stay safe, be well, drive carefully, hug your loved ones, and Aloha America.